court will now proceed to oral argument in United States against Chatfield. We shall hear first from counsel for appellant. I would note for the record that Judge Ryan will participate in these proceedings on the record.
May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Kathleen Cadlick, and I represent the appellant here today, Lieutenant Junior Grade Stephen Chatfield. Gentlemen, we're here today to talk about the military officer's conditioning to follow implied orders. On the day in question, Lieutenant Commander Hoffeins, the operations officer on board this ship, reported to the wardroom and told appellant to change his clothes and report to the chaplain. Appellant did so. Appellant was then informed of the charges against him. Moments later, the XO reported to the chaplain's stateroom, knocked on the door, and said, "Let's go."
Is it ordinary practice to give orders and commands to service personnel through the chaplain?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. The XO did testify on the record that in any instance like this, they do have the accused talk to the chaplain.
What does the record reflect as to why the chaplain seems to be a focal point in this case?
It was more from the XO's testimony, Your Honor. It's more of out of a concern, actually, for the accused, as opposed to a formal.
And does that help or hurt your argument?
Probably it's not as strong as a case as far as informing them as it's done through the chaplain and the purpose for which it was done. Appellant's main contention in this case is that he was given an order to go and report with the XO to the Jacksonville Police Department, irregardless of how he was informed of the charges. Appellant's contention is that he was given an order to go to the police department. He was actually delivered there by the XO, who told him on the way that you will stay here, and upon completion of this, when we're done with dinner, we will pick you up. There were a few variations in that. If it was finished before they terminated their dinner, the detective would have called.
What are your three best facts in the record and why it was in order?
Why it was in order?
If you were to give us the page sites and the text, the three most persuasive facts.
I may be a little bit rusty on the page sites.
You can pick an MJ finding or something else, but
the three best facts in the record would be the XO saying, "Let's go." The testimony of Lieutenant Commander Hoffeins, who testified contrary to the XO as to what he thought the plan was that day.
What specifically in his testimony?
Specifically in that testimony. He recalled nothing whatsoever, and I can't cite to the joint appendix on this. It's 121 to 122, Your Honor. Talking about the trial counsel was trying to confirm the XO's intent that day, and Lieutenant Commander Hoffeins said, "That is completely not my recollection. I was informed that we were going to play off leaving the ship, so the rest of the wardroom wasn't know. It was more along the lines of I was told we were taking him down there to be interviewed." The third best fact in the record that this was in order, I guess, would be the testimony by Detective Amanetti, who testified that the XO said, "We are going to eat. Let us know when you are done."
When we look at this and analyze it, are we analyzing a reasonable naval officer with the appellant's experience and background, or do we discount that and just use a reasonable person standard to the circumstances of the custody or non-custody?
You must use a reasonable military person standpoint. Any reasonable civilian would not be attuned to the actual pressures in military society.
Could you point out in the military judge's findings and conclusions those specific findings or conclusions that are clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor. There is conflicting testimony as to finding of fact number 10 about the department heads informing him that he wanted to be interviewed.
Now, if it's conflicting, doesn't necessarily mean that it's not supported by the record.
If it's conflicting, Your Honor, it's the military judge's burden to resolve that conflict, which the military judge did not do in this case.
And why is that conflict significant in this case?
Because the intent of the XO very well have may have been the intent of the XO, but what matters is from a reasonable person standpoint and what was actually communicated to the appellant. Now, if there's a discrepancy there about what that perception was and, you know, what a reasonable person would have thought giving this communication, then that is essential to having a solid finding of fact that's not clearly erroneous, Your Honor.
Okay. Where's the conflict there? I mean, I don't know if I'm following.
Well, the conflict being, Your Honor, that there's an intent espoused by the XO about what was going to happen, and the only person that had the XO did not have any communication with appellants. It was the operations officer, Lieutenant Commander Hoffines. And so he's talking about his intent, and then he actually says it was communicated back to him that he was willing to give a statement, and there's no other evidence in the record of that. The only evidence of anybody that spoke to him about this was Lieutenant Commander Hoffines, who testified or who told him to collect him, change into his clothes, and report to the chaplain's office.
How does a lack of testimony that isn't consistent with this make it a conflict?
It's a conflict in that Lieutenant Commander Hoffhein's recollection of what the plan was for that day differed from the XO. So it goes to say that if he actually communicated with him, it would have been more of the lines of, we're taking you to the police station. It wasn't an option. Is that clear, Your Honor?
Did you get to finish your list, if any, of MJ findings of fact that you believe are clearly erroneous?
I will keep going with that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Just make sure you get it out before you leave.
I will, Your Honor. Okay. Back to finding of fact number 10 and concluding that Lieutenant Commander Hoffhein's testimony. The military judge also held that Lieutenant Commander Compton was present for the conversation in the chaplain's stateroom. There's actually nothing in the record to substantiate that. Nobody ever testified that he was there.
Why is that critical?
It just goes to the erroneous findings of fact. And it's critical in the sense that the XO couldn't recall which department head was communicating with the XO. He thought it was Hoffhines. He wasn't sure. And so by virtue of Lieutenant Commander Compton not being anywhere involved in this situation, it goes to the findings that is clearly erroneous because he was not involved in this situation at all.
The military judge has numerous findings here. What did the military judge actually find about what was communicated to the appellant in this case about going to the police? What did he ever reach a specific finding? You could see you're a little under the weather. Take your time that you need to refresh yourself and answer the questions.
I don't think he found that the XO was credible and that his intent was to communicate that. And I do believe he found by a preponderance of evidence that was communicated, that there was an option, that this was optional. And if you want to do this, we will take you down there. Unfortunately, I can't point to the specific finding on that right now, Your Honor. Additionally, as far as erroneous and the findings of fact, the military judge never reconciled the statements by the government witnesses that appellant appeared that he had no other option but to be there. Detective Emanetti testified to that at length, and it was also admitted by the XO that appellant could have perceived that he had no other option but to comply and go talk to the detective.
You used the term, when you started, you used the term implied order. I thought I heard you say that.
You did, Your Honor. This was not an instance of you are going to do A. It was more of an
orders normally implied? Are enforceable orders normally implied?
Normally they are not, but there are such things as implied orders, and given the military and the command structure.
Well, can you cite me a case in which an implied order was held to be enforceable?
I cannot.
Code sanction?
I cannot do that, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Back to the military judge's findings of fact. As far, it's more in the omissions of the findings of fact, I guess, is where he was wrong. That concludes the list of ones that I think that are actually erroneous. Overtly, there was just never a reconciliation of certain testimony in the record. There was one more addition, if I may. The military judge held that they were going to come back and take the accused to dinner, but that was never actually in the plan. The plan was just to leave him there at the police station and collect him when they came back.
How do you deal with the Baird bifurcation? By which I mean, in Baird, the court said, even if we were to accept the Pavlovian implications of the court's assertion that military officers are conditioned to follow all but the most obviously illegal orders, the court then ultimately said the issue is this left our men in a position to find blah, blah, blah. I'm sorry, I've lost my train of thought. They then went on to conclude it was nonetheless that he wasn't ordered to give a statement, Baird wasn't. He was still free to voluntarily decide whether to give the statement. You see, they broke it off. They accepted the Pavlovian dog wandering down to the police station, but then said, but that's not the issue. The issue is the voluntariness of the statement.
My reading of Baird hinges on the fact that the overt acts of the detective in that case, saying this is a expressly saying to the appellant in that case, this is a voluntary interview, and you can leave at any time. That is not the facts of this case, Your Honor.
So that's how you would distinguish Baird from your case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Baird is a 1988 decision by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Is that decision binding on our court?
By no means, Your Honor. It's just the most similar case, the most similar federal circuit case.
Should we regard Baird as persuasive authority in this case?
Yes,
I'm not asking whether we should come to the same result, but should we regard it as persuasive authority?
Helen regards that as persuasive, Your Honor. The military judge erred in several omissions as well as the overt misstatements of the record. And it's clear that a reasonable person would have thought that they were in custody and their movements constrained in this case.
Does the record reflect Chatfield is a reservist, is that correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was Chatfield a reservist?
A reservist. My review of the defense exhibits Alpha and Bravo indicates the majority of his time was on active duty. He did go back to college, obtaining a BA, or, I'm sorry, I believe it was a BS, that was conferred in August of 2000. So possibly the reservist implications at that point, but it's unclear from the record how much was reserved.
So the record says he had both the facts say both active and reserve service, but it doesn't indicate how much was what and what.
No, it doesn't.
Does it give any indication whether during his reserve time he had a civilian job or employment?
It doesn't, but a logical reading of the record would be, and I'll again direct you to defense exhibits A and B, is that that probably stemmed from his attending school at Pennsylvania State University, was my guess.
Counsel, you've centered most of your argument on the events that happened up until the appellant got to the police station, the Navy's involvement in getting him there. What about after he got there, using the more traditional criteria of whether this was custody or not custody? What's your view on that?
The more traditional criteria are difficult to apply in this case, Your Honor, because of the facts.
Let's take away how he got there.
Okay.
And let's just start with the fact that he is at the police station now, and the tenor of the totality of the circumstances from that point on.
Sure. There are things, you know, there was a conversational interview. The door was open to the office. It was not held in an interrogation room. There was an office, pictures on the wall. It wasn't exactly a very confined office. There's no indication that he was offered anything to eat or drink, but Detective Amanetti did step out of the room at times.
Are the military judge's findings in regard to those circumstances clearly erroneous?
They are not, Your Honor. This case hinges on the directive of the XO and the confinement at the police station. I mean, appellant could not leave that police station, and it was implied that he was going to participate in this and cooperate.
Your argument is that he was in custody in the police station because he believed he was under a military order.
Yes, and a reasonable, you know, using the reasonable person standard. And then
are you depending on custody or the fact that you feel he was compelled?
Both. It's a two-prong argument, that he was in custody and was not read his Miranda rights. The military judge found it inconclusive on the record that that was done. And secondly, that it was involuntary as well.
If, following up on Judge Erdman and what happened in the police station, if Alvarado is still good law, and I realize Alvarado takes a totality of circumstances approach, but if Alvarado is a good law, is still good law, and this interrogation of a 17-year-old kid wasn't custodial, how does your man win?
He was arrested at the end of the day. And I do not believe Alvarado was. He had no choice to be there. Alvarado's parents did take him to the police station, and that was a factor. but it's really the military conditioning in this case that makes that distinguishes it.
The implied order, the military conditioning, and the fact that was he in custody when he was in the car?
Custody probably attached, yes, when he was in the car, yes.
Thank you.
So. And anyway, I apologize. My time has expired. If I
you can
finish
you can
this.
Okay. You can take a moment now if you have a further thought that you want to convey, and you'll also have an opportunity in rebuttal.
Yes, I just want to point out again for Judge Stuckey that Alvarado was allowed to go home, and it is the military situation in this case that distinguishes it from that.
Right. Thank you, counsel. Court will now hear from counsel for the first amicus arguing on behalf of appellant.
May it please the court. My name is Tasha Niestaus, and I represent the amicus curiae from Texas Tech School of Law, arguing in support of appellant Lieutenant Junior Grade Stephen Chatfield. I would like to thank the court for the opportunity for amicus to participate in this additional argument. Lieutenant Chatfield's statements were involuntarily given to Detective Amonetti. Therefore, the trial judge abused his discretion in not granting the motion to suppress. Under Rule 304 of the Military Rules of Evidence, a statement is involuntary if it is in violation of the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, Article 31 of the UCMJ, or was coerced, unlawfully induced, or unlawfully influenced. In this case, Your Honor, Lieutenant Chatfield was unlawfully coerced, influenced, or induced to give these statements, and there should have been an Article 31B warning given by some member of the chain of command. In this case, Your Honor, looking at the whole situation, not just what happened in the interrogation room, but the whole situation, the military was involved from basically start to finish if Lieutenant Chatfield had not been arrested. Detective Amonetti, in fact, called the chain of command in this case and requested to speak with Lieutenant Chatfield. XO Landis, at that point, was well apprised of the allegations against Lieutenant Chatfield. With knowing these allegations, Lieutenant Chatfield could have been a suspect under the UCMJ, and in this case, he was tried for indecent assault as well as disorderly conduct.
How do you get around the testimony and the findings by the military judge that at no time did the XO or the CO consider this to be a UCMJ matter?
Your Honor, in this case, I believe that the testimony the court below stated that there couldn't have been a finding that this was a UCMJ violation, or even a reasonable person cannot find this was a UCMJ violation. However, this was clearly a violation of the UCMJ since he was tried and charged for it in the court-martial, and just knowing that he could have been a suspect for this case, XO Landis should have been apprised that he needed to give Article 31B warnings to Lieutenant Chatfield to protect him against what could happen in the office
Does a duty to give an Article 31 warning attach whenever a member of the armed forces is involved in the civilian criminal justice system, whenever there's a call from downtown that we'd like to speak to X? Does that automatically give trigger an obligation to give Article 31 warnings?
No
case law for that?
No, Your Honor. But in this case, when there is a same sort of factual situation in which the military is basically going to deliver Lieutenant Chatfield on a silver platter to the civilian authorities, and then later, if he hadn't been arrested, we're going to pick him up and escort him back with three commanding officers in the car with him back to the USS Austin, the military is basically participating in the investigation. They're handing over Lieutenant Chatfield to the civilian
authorities. It's a military investigation in which the civilians are acting as an agent or vice versa, or what is it?
No, Your Honor. This is not a military investigation in which the civilian authority is an agent. Amicus is not arguing that Detective Amoretti should have given Article 31B warnings, but that the chain of command, knowing the situation that they were going to put Lieutenant Chatfield in, in fact, XO Landis stated that on, page 109 of the record, that I thought that XO Landis thought that the detective was going to Mirandize Lieutenant Chatfield. And, in fact, he thought that because there were allegations against him. And, in fact, in this case, detective did not Mirandize him until some point later, once he had gotten the incriminating statements from Lieutenant Chatfield.
Are you, which text in Article 31 are you keying off of?
Article 31B, saying that from an accused or person suspected of an offense without first informing him of the nature of the crime that he is accused of, advising him of his rights, or letting him know that he can remain silent. And in this case, even though XO Landis...
Also, I believe you've left out some critical words from the statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
Who he has to give the warnings, who do they have to give the warnings to, and when do they have to give the warnings? That is, what occurs before they have to give the warnings?
Yes, Your Honor. If there is a question or request of a statement from the accused by the person who is investigating, there needs to be...
No, that's not... I don't believe that's what the statute says. Doesn't the statute refer to a member, a person who is subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice?
Yes, Your Honor.
And who, in this case, subject to the military Uniform Code of Military Justice, posed an inquiry to the appellant?
Your Honor, Amicus would argue that the chain of command, in fact, requested a statement from Lieutenant Chatfield by putting him in the situation in which he needed to speak with Detective Amoretti. In fact, XO Landis stated in his testimony during the suppression hearing that, I believe we, meaning the chain of command, related to Lieutenant Chatfield that he would have to give a statement sometime soon, if not within the next 24 hours. There was not only the pressure of the chain of command, but the time sensitivity that Lieutenant Chatfield had in giving this statement. The ship was about to leave for the sea, and Lieutenant Chatfield was basically urged by the commanding officer and the commanding chain of command to give a statement in order to see so he could join the ship and then go out to sea.
But how do you get around the language in the statute that the Chief Judge pointed out that the questioner has to be subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice? That seems pretty clear.
Yes, Your Honor. And while I do not have any case law that goes directly to that, in looking at the intent of Congress when they enacted Article 31, the intent of Congress was to protect subordinates from the chain of command. And in this case, what could happen, and if this factual scenario occurs again, what could happen is a rogue officer or a commanding officer could just fail to give the subordinate a warning, send him off to civilian authority, have the civilian authority interrogate the accused, and then that statement is used and turned around against and used in a court-martial.
If the civilian authority is questioning the accused, why don't we then deal with the law that applies to civilians? Why don't we just go with Miranda?
Because in this case, Your Honor, Lieutenant Chapel was not charged under the civilian authority's laws. Lieutenant Chapel was charged in a court-martial, and the military used whatever was stated to Detective Amoretti against the accused without informing him of his rights. He was turned around and used against him in the court-martial in this case.
Go ahead. Finish your answer.
Your Honor, it basically usurps the purpose, the entire purpose of Article 31. The defendant in this case was left unaware that he could either remain silent or that he could have counsel.
You referred to the need for hurry because the ship was going underway the next day, and you talked about him having to go along with the ship. doesn't that rather undercut the notion that they wanted to do anything to, that they, the chain of command, wanted to do with it, anything with him? And doesn't that rather confirm the judge's findings of fact that they had no inkling that there was going to be any UCMJ action? They just want their man on the ship. If you're going to prosecute somebody for an offense against a shipmate, are you going to be in a big hurry to get him on the ship and go underway with it?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of the military aspect of that, but in this case, when looking at the pressure...
I'm saying, does it make sense as a matter of command authority?
I'm not sure if he could be charged on when he was on the ship of committing this crime of indecent assault, if he was questioned again. But the pressure, the compelling purpose behind that was to hurry up and basically request a statement from Lieutenant Chatfield so we could then, the ship could then get it on its way. And in this case, that compulsion is
which
what...
doesn't that bolster the judge's findings that they didn't see any UCMJ implications in this at all?
Well, Your Honor, this court looked at a situation in United States versus Moorhead in which it decided when Article 31B warnings would be invoked. And the rule behind that is if there is a person is accused of being a suspect of an offense. And in this case, XO Landis clearly knew that the defendant, or the appellant in this case, Lieutenant Chatfield, was a suspect of an offense. He was well aware of the crimes against him. And in this case, I'd like to go to what Judge Baker mentioned to appellate counsel. There are mentions in the record that show this was directly an order. The let's go statement is on page 97 of the record. The statement about we related to him that he'd need to make a statement is on page 118 of the record. And the very fact that Lieutenant Chatfield stated, I was simply told to put on my civilian clothing and go to the chaplain's room, was simply following orders. He is a enlisted man that's now a lieutenant. It cuts against the appellee counsel's argument that simply because he was in the military for such a long
time. Are military orders usually conveyed through chaplains?
Your Honor, I'm not aware that...
Is that how you'd convey an order?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but...
There you are on the bridge, and you want the helmsman to turn left, and you say, report, and you say, get the chaplain so I can convey the order.
Your Honor, I see I'm almost out of time. My brief.
Oh, you've got
question.
Enough time to answer that okay. question.
In this case, Your Honor.
In all seriousness, how do you deal with that? That's a fact that's in play here.
Well, the chaplain advised Lieutenant Chatfield of what he was being accused of. The order came when XO Landis opened the door, poked his head in, and said, "Let's go." That was the order that Lieutenant Chatfield followed and followed directly. I see I'm out of time. May
you're not out of time. You can finish answering the question.
Thank you, Chief Judge. To address the United States versus Beard case that was brought up earlier in the argument, this is very different from United States versus Beard in that the military compulsion, the military stance, ended at the door of the interrogation room. This military
but
compulsion.
But counsel, that's not what I understand your argument to be about the Article 31B warnings. Your argument has been that the Article 31B warnings, the military self-incrimination warnings, arose when the members of the armed forces received the call from the civilian police authority, and in your view, the military officers suspected him of an offense prosecutable under the UCMJ, and your view was that they then had to give an Article 31B warning, that the subsequent events had nothing to do with that. So if that's your view, Isn't it the case, then, that you would say that the D.C. Circuit was incorrect in Baird and that we should disregard the decision in Baird? Because in Baird, they said, not a problem at that point, no Article 31B warnings required.
Well, Your Honor, not necessarily relating to the Article 31B argument, but it
well, why don't you answer that question that I had, and then you can answer the question that you want to address.
Yes, Your Honor. It is Amicus's contention that at any point before he was dropped off at the interview room, he should have been read as Article 31B warnings.
Thank you. Then was Baird incorrectly decided?
Baird was incorrect, or was correctly decided in that case, in which there is compulsion and influence, but was cured when the detective and the investigator stated, "You're free to go at any time."
So the D.C. Circuit got it right for the wrong reason.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may conclude your argument.
It's for these reasons that Amicus asks this court remand back to the trial level and authorize a rehearing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, we'll now hear from counsel for the government.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge, Your Honor. I'm Captain Jeff Shows, along with Colonel Lou Puglio. I represent the United States in this appeal. In order to determine if appellant's statement was admissible at trial, this court must ask three questions. First being, was there custody? Second, was there an interrogation? And third, was the statement voluntary? Now, obviously, there was an interrogation that takes care of itself, but the other two questions require a bit of analysis. With respect to custody, Your Honor, the military judge did not err when he concluded that, based on his findings of facts, which are supported by the record, which were adopted by the lower court, and applied to the proper law, that appellant was not in custody at the time he gave his statement.
I know you have a spiel you want to do, but turning your attention to paragraph 17, conclusions of law, and finding of fact 8, is, in your view, is this a correct conclusion of law? That in view of the limited information provided to him by civilian authorities, the XO did not suspect, nor should he reasonably have suspected, that the accused had violated the UCMJ. And finding 8 says, both the CO and XO agreed that any allegations were a matter for civilian authorities. Now, that's a finding which says what they agreed to, not whether they agreed to it accurately. But the conclusion of law says that that was a reasonable conclusion, that a Navy person on Navy person, officer on officer, Navy event involving people in the same crew of a ship that then was reported to Navy medical personnel, they reasonably concluded that it had nothing to do with military discipline or justice. Is that a correct conclusion of law?
Well, it is, Your Honor, insofar as they concluded.
So it's not of concern to an XO or CO of a ship if an officer is accused of sexually assaulting another officer and the alleged victim reports it to the medical personnel of the ship. That's a civilian matter.
Well, that
is. That's a reasonable conclusion?
Well, it is, Your Honor, insofar as the executive officer stated that because it was reported to the civilian detective and the civilian detective reported or basically briefed the executive officer on the charges in a casual conversation, trying to get appellate down to the station for an interview.
And so the government's taking the view that it's a reasonable that that's not a matter for the UCMJ, putting aside concurrent jurisdiction.
It could be a matter for the UCMJ, Your Honor.
Could be?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, under what circumstance would it not be an offense under the UCMJ?
Well, no, Your Honor, it would be a matter for the UCMG. However,
it's so is reasonable for the XO to conclude it wasn't a matter for the civilian? I mean, which is it? Is that a reasonable conclusion of law?
Whenever the XO said it was not a matter for the UCMG at that time, Your Honor, he was talking about it being a civilian matter and civilian authorities taking cognizance over the charge and over the allegations. And he said if the civilians decided not to pursue the charges, at that point they would take it for action under the UCMJ and gather their own information and make the point of the decision.
This is hypothetical and not the facts, but if in this case the XO had asked any questions calling for an incriminating answer from the appellant, would the fact that the XO at that point anticipated that civilian authorities would handle it excuse in any way his not giving Article 31 warnings?
No, Your Honor. If the XO asked a question trying to solicit incriminating information, Article 31 rights should be read.
So how could the military judge base a conclusion of law on the question of whether this case would or would not have been prosecuted in civilian courts? What bearing does that have here as to whether either Article 31B or Miranda warnings were required?
Wait, I'm sorry.
What bearing does it have on this case, what the XO might have thought about where the case would or would not have been prosecuted? Wouldn't any well-informed, reasonable XO understand that this is a case that could potentially wind up in the military justice system?
Sure, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The conclusion of law, paragraph 4, the military judge states that the distinguishing factor in this case is that the XO never spoke to the accused. Putting aside whether or not it was an order, sides disagree on that, must an order come directly from the XO in order to be an order from the XO?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't have to. The XO can give the order to the operations officer, his junior officer who's superior to the appellate, and get passed that way.
So it may be a factor, but in your view, what in fact is the distinguishing factor in your view here?
As far as what, Your Honor?
What is the pivot point? The appellant got listed three facts that appellant felt was the pivot point factually as to why this was an order. For you, what is the pivot point for why this was not an order or direction? You can choose your term of art.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I would recommend that because...
It can't be because the XO didn't speak to the person. We've just agreed upon that. What is the key fact?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say because... As appellant admitted or stated that he first heard of the allegations from the chaplain, that's finding of fact 13. Finding of fact 21, the executive officer, when dropped off to Detective Aminette, indicated at the conclusion of this interview, we're going to pick him up and take him to get dinner on the way back to the ship. And appellant does admit that the executive officer never told him directly. So, and again, that goes more to voluntariness. But the fact that he was never told directly by the executive officer, and so his contention is that he was compelled by the executive officer, or disingenuous, Your Honor.
Well, what did the military judge find? Who told him what? Where in the record do we find in this case who told the appellant to put himself in a place where he was going to travel to the civilian law enforcement officials?
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, the record of trial and the military judge's findings of fact don't specifically say who told appellant what, when.
And since that seems to have some bearing on the issue of compulsion in this case, why should we give any deference to the military judge's findings here where he didn't solve that critical fact, either to say that this is the testimony that's here or the testimony isn't here, or in the absence of testimony, we can't say? How can we give any deference to a military judge's findings of fact when they're vacant on a critical issue of fact?
Well, Your Honor, this court can still support the military judge's findings of fact if it finds there are omissions in there, if the findings of fact are supported by the record, rendering them not clearly erroneous. And these findings of fact are supported by the record of trial.
Is it your view that if findings of fact are 100% correct, but critical aspects of the factual scenario are missing, we are compelled to say that the military judge's findings are not clearly erroneous in those circumstances? That is, if the military judge omits a critical historical developments in the sequence, does that have any bearing on whether his findings of fact as a whole are clearly erroneous or not?
Well, Your Honor, if this court concludes that the military judge's findings of fact do possess critical omissions, then this court can certainly send it back to correct that error and expand that. But again, the standard we have are these findings of fact are supported by the record, and what we have to look at is objectively, based on these findings of fact, what the military judge said as a findings of fact, because they are supported by the record, objectively, would a reasonable person felt that he was in custody?
And when the appellant was at the police station, it's the government's view that he was free to leave. Is that the government's view? He was free to leave. Did he have to wait until his command came and picked him back up again?
His commanding officer gave him his cell phone number, Your Honor, and said, "Give me a call whenever you're ready to leave," and that's in the record of trial, Your Honor. And
did he say when you're ready to leave or when the interview's finished?
He said when you're finished, Your Honor. But again, the standard for custody is not what appellant subjectively thought at the time. The standard is, would a reasonable person in his situation have felt that he was compelled to stick around for the interview?
Reasonable man, reasonable naval officer, reasonable what?
Well, the government, we can see that in this situation, is a reasonable officer, Your Honor. And even D.C. Circuit...
Which way does that cut?
Well, that would cut in favor ever so slightly for appellant, Your Honor. But again, that's not dispositive on the issue because we still have to look at the circumstances as a whole. And again, what took place on the ship itself is not dispositive of the custody issue, because that has to be decided once we get to the police station.
Is custody the sole issue? Could this be a voluntary statement if, in fact, he were ordered to give it and he wasn't in custody?
If he was not
in custody. Just as a matter of theory, I'm not saying that's these facts, but what if your battalion commander says, I order you to go down there and make a statement? And you go down there, and from the law enforcement standpoint, you're not in custody. You walk in. Is that still a voluntary statement?
That would be a voluntariness issue, Your Honor. At that point, so.
I'm not asking you to concede the voluntariness. I'm asking you to, I'm trying to test whether, as a matter of legal theory alone, custody is dispositive or not. In that case, there'd still be an issue of voluntariness, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so custody is not the sole issue in a case where orders are given or not given or whatever.
Certainly
fair enough,
not, Your Honor. Yes, okay. Your Honor.
Counsel, let's go back to conclusion 17B, and let's just assume, for argument's sake, that that was clearly erroneous, that the military judge got that wrong. What's the consequences of that? Does that, if in fact the military judge was wrong in his legal conclusion in 17B, does that necessarily mean there was an Article 31B violation?
No, Your Honor.
Why is that?
Well, the Article 31 Bravo analysis has two things. Investigations merge, or was a civilian authority acting as an instrument? And in this case, the findings of fact illustrate that neither of those two situations arose. So based on that analysis, there are no 31 Bravo implications of this case, Your Honor.
Counsel, let's take a look at Article 86 of the UCMJ, the absence article.
That's right.
And absence from a place of duty. The appellant in this case went with superiors to the police station, and when he was at the police station, he was told that that was where he was supposed to be, perhaps not, and that he would be there until the superiors either came back or received a call from him that he was finished. Was appellant free to leave prior to either of those conditions taking place under Article 86? Or to put it another way, if he had walked out of the police station at that time and his command had charged him with an absence offense under Article 86, would the government here be saying, we concede error, couldn't convict him of an Article 86 offense because he had no obligation to be there at the police station?
Your Honor, if that was his appointed place of duty at that time, then he could be convicted of Article 86. However,
and wasn't that his appointed place of duty at the time? He went there with his command. His command left him there. His command told him to that there were only two conditions under which he could leave: if they came back or he called them. So, under those circumstances, wasn't he required to be at that police station until one of those two conditions came back? And wasn't he subject to prosecution under Article 86 if he just walked out of the police station?
Well, in that case, if he were threatened with Article 86 specifically for leaving on his own out of the police station, certainly in that situation, Your Honor. But again, looking at the
facts. Then why wouldn't that constitute custody here if he'd face criminal prosecution for doing what any civilian could have done in that situation? Any civilian, if he was in that situation, could have walked away from the police station. This military person had a place of duty then, didn't he? And his place of duty was there, and he was required to be there. So how could he leave?
Well, Your Honor, he was told to call the XO whenever he was ready to leave. So under these facts, again, we have to look at it from these facts. There was no threat of charging prosecution under Article 86 or Article 92. The executive officer said, and the only thing that defined as a fact, said that the executive officer told him, here's my cell phone number, give me a call when you're finished. He passed the same word on to Detective Aminetti. Now, based on these findings of fact, looking objectively, would a reasonable person feel free to leave and terminate the interview? And it's imperative that we stick to that analysis, because that's how we've got to look at it. It doesn't matter what appellant says he felt. It doesn't matter that appellant says he felt compelled. What matters is, would a reasonable person objectively, in appellant's situation, based on these findings of facts as they are here, would he feel that there was formal arrest or restraint on freedom associated with formal arrest.
So a reasonable sailor, Marine, could feel in those circumstances he could just walk away, walk out of that police station.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know how far the police station was from the restaurant, but the executive officer did tell him, and that's reasonable because the executive officer was his ride, and he gave him his number and said, give me a call when you're finished. And so under those circumstances, there's no dispute. I can't see how it could possibly be custody when he's told, give me a call when you're ready to leave, and we're going to take you to get dinner at the conclusion of the interview.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
What are the finding of fact 11 and 12? The military judge found that the XO told one of the department heads or the chaplain to advise the accused that if he wanted to go, that they would go in a group. And the XO could not recall through which of the department heads, blah, blah, blah. He had passed word to the accused. Is that the basis for the conclusion of law that he voluntarily went down there?
Not solely, Your Honor. And again, the...
And that's really not my question. My real question is, what in the record would you point to specifically that supports that finding of fact and that conclusion of law? For example, page 112, blah, blah, blah.
Now you're saying the finding of fact. Which finding of fact are you talking about,
that
Your Honor?
That the XO told the department head to advise the accused that if he wanted to go, and that the he had and that he couldn't remember to whom... he said it to, but he had passed word to the accused, which seems to be the basis for concluding that he knew it was voluntary.
Well,
or tell me some other basis for concluding that he knew it was voluntary.
To answer your question directly, Your Honor, as far as those findings of fact are supported by pages 96 and 99 of the joint appendix, as well as the fact that he testified he received word that he was willing to go, finding of fact 14, Your Honor. However, again, for the purpose of the custody analysis, the subjective thoughts, and again, the military judge carefully crafted these findings of fact not to confuse that the appellant was told it was voluntary. He carefully crafted it to say the executive officer testified that this is what he said. But again, the subjective thoughts of the executive officer for the custody analysis are totally irrelevant. Even if it would inure to the benefit of the government, Your Honor, even if he subjectively thought that it was voluntary, it doesn't really matter.
I'm not pushing on that door. I'm just making sure I have all the critical facts from both sides.
Your Honor.
Go ahead.
No, sir, please.
If we decide that the statement ought to have been suppressed, is there enough here that we can say it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Without the statement, Your Honor, and without the accompanying testimony by Detective Amanetti, which basically is the testimony that goes to digital penetration in this case, Your Honor, the facts obviously are going to hinge on, or the decision will hinge on, the eyewitness testimony of the Lieutenant Buckner and Lieutenant Hedvall and the testimony of the victim in this case. And here she said she woke up, she found a appellant behind her, her underwear had been pulled down to her knees, she felt like she'd been penetrated, and she felt the appellant grabbing her from behind. We have the testimony, again, of Lieutenant Buckner, who said he woke up before the victim in the same bed and saw appellant behind her, tucked in behind her, and there was rustling at his waist under the covers. There's no eyewitness testimony that appellant specifically penetrated her digitally, Your Honor. However, there is circumstantial evidence that could establish that.
Is that enough to make it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, the standard, Your Honor, is if the error reasonably.
If that hadn't gone in, would it have changed?
Certainly, Your Honor, because members are allowed to find.
In other words, are you conceding that?
No, Your Honor. Members and the members were instructed that they could convict based exclusively on circumstantial evidence. And again, they were instructed based on your own life experiences, ways of knowledge of the ways of the world, things of that nature, that you could apply that to your findings of the fact and resolve disputes in this case. And based on the eyewitness testimony, they still could have found him guilty, even without the statement and the testimony of Detective Amanetti, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, Your Honor, I see my time is running out, if I'll just briefly conclude.
They do so.
Essentially, request this court find that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in concluding that it was a non-custodial interrogation an appellant voluntarily made a statement that we respectfully request this court approve the findings and sentence as approved by the lower court.
Thank you, counsel. Court will now hear from the second amicus arguing on behalf of the government's position.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Judge. May it please the court. My name is John Clark, on behalf of the amicus curiae at Texas Tech University School of Law. Arguing on behalf of the appellee, the United States. The appellant contends that Chatfield's admission was taken in violation of Miranda, which requires a reading of his Miranda rights when there is an interrogation while he is in custody. The crux of the appellant's argument rests on Chatfield being ordered to go to the police station. However, this court should hold that Chatfield was not in custody for two reasons. First, the record indicates that he was willing to attend the interview. And second, even if he was forced to go, that fact alone does not constitute custody. As I mentioned, Your Honors, the appellant contends that he was in custody because he was forced to go meet with Detective Amonetti. However, this is a case that is on all fours with Oregon v. Mathiasen in that he went voluntarily. The record indicates in both the testimony of Amonetti and Commander Landis that they did not seek out Lieutenant Chatfield, but waited for him to return to base, at which point they requested if he was willing to go. His response was that he was willing.
Which conversation between Landis and the appellant are you referring to in this case?
Your Honor, there's not a direct conversation between Landis and the appellant.
Doesn't the record seem to indicate that there was a conversation through a third party?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the record indicate who that third party was?
Hoffines, Your Honor.
Hoffines. And what does Hoffines' testimony say?
Hoffines doesn't recall exactly what he said. The order that he was given from Landis was to ask if Chatfield was willing to go. Landis testified that the response that he received from Commander Hoffines was that Chatfield was indeed willing.
So under those circumstances, how can we conclude as a matter of law that we have a situation here in which an individual was not compelled to do what military people are compelled to do when they receive requests from their superiors, and that is appear at the police station?
Your Honor, based on that alone, this court could not conclude. However, considering other facts, that not only did Commander Landis understand that he was willing to go, but Detective Amonetti did as well. And he testified that he understood that Chatfield came to the station willingly, and that that he also personally believed that Chatfield came willingly.
Didn't the judge find that Hoffines couldn't recall about saying anything directly to the accused?
Correct, Your Honor. Hoffines did not recall.
Okay, and the other department head didn't testify, and the chaplain didn't testify.
Correct, Your Honor.
So what is there to support the assertion that somebody told the accused something?
Well, other than he went, and he did testify that
okay.
Nobody...
he also found that the chaplain told him about it.
Yeah, he testified that the chaplain told him what he was charged of. There wasn't a whole lot of discussion of what happened in his conversation with the chaplain because of the confidential nature of that conversation.
Okay.
Does your position depend on him appearing voluntarily at the police station?
Your Honor, it doesn't depend upon whether he was ordered, whether he was ordered to go or not. In fact, that would take me into my second point, Your Honor, is that even if he was ordered to go, that it did not constitute custody. For instance, in the United States Supreme Court case of Minnesota versus Murphy, the court discussed a probationer who was forced to go by his probation officer to the meeting with that officer.
The appellant said that the key distinction between this case and the pattern in Baird was that in Baird, the person was told when they got to the police station that they were free to go. Did that happen here?
Your Honor, Chatfield wasn't told he was free to go. However, in a totality of the circumstances review, he also was not told anything. And as the Third Circuit pointed out in United States v. Lease, it is important that he was not told that he was not free to leave as well.
Now, assuming for the sake of arguing theory, let's stipulate the Pavlovian dog syndrome here.
Mm-hmm.
how do you distinguish, how do you address appellant's argument that the key distinction is that he was not told he could go?
Your Honor.
Assuming Pavlov's dog.
Assuming, as Baird did. When we can look at Baird as being very instructive, while nothing was said in this case, the stamp of military authority in Baird was greater than that here. In Baird, the superior officer brought the gave a direct order to go meet with the investigator, then said, this investigator has some questions for you. Asked the investigator if he would like the superior to remain present, and when the investigator told him no, said, well, if you need anything else, let me know. In this case, there is almost no interest from Landis shown up as far as the interrogation was concerned at all, except how Chatfield would get there. And the conduct of Detective Aminetti, if we apply the bifurcated situation in Baird, the conduct of Detective Aminetti is clearly towards a non-custodial situation, in that Chatfield was not searched, was not handcuffed or restrained in any way.
In Minnesota v. Murphy, was the probationer told he could leave?
No, Your Honor. He was also not told he could leave in that case. Okay. And there are additionally a number of cases where an individual who has been not told he was free to leave, and the court has found non-custodial. Also, Your Honor, Your Honor's brought up earlier, Yarbrough v. Alvarado is another case where an individual was brought to the police station, not necessarily of his own free will, and that was another case where the United States Supreme Court held that there was that there was no custody in that case.
In your case, you focus on Griffin and the Griffin factors, which is an Eighth Circuit case.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you were advising this court, are you encouraging us to adopt the Griffin factors? And if you're encouraging us to adopt the Griffin factors, are there any military-specific aspects to it that you would add to any Griffin-type test?
First, Your Honor, I would suggest this court does adopt the Griffin factors in the similar way that they did, and that they're a non-exhaustive list. Some of the things that may be considered in the military context may be whether the individual was ordered to go there directly. But again, none of those factors.
So you would say, if you were advising the court on how you would write the opinion, if you were writing the opinion, you'd say Griffin factors plus military factor 9, ordered to go or not?
Yes, Your Honor. That seems to be something that would clearly need to be included in a military situation.
Any other military factors that would bear?
None that I can think of at this moment, Your Honor. I strike that. Potentially whether he was read his Article 31 rights. But that would probably change the situations in which Griffin would be applied. Although Griffin does include a number of the factors that are from various courts that have been considered, it does leave out others, whether force was, I believe it does include force. But some other things that have been considered, such as the presence of weapons, things like that, might not be as significant in a military context. Military personnel are generally more comfortable with the appearance of weapons.
What about the grade of the military person involved? Should that come to bear?
Typically, under a custody analysis for Miranda, those subjective factors wouldn't be considered under the Miranda analysis itself on a more voluntariness level than they would come in. But I would, following the line of Miranda cases, it would not be included in the analysis. One situation that may include some additional circumstances for military context is the last factor in Griffin, which regarding the arrest of the individual at the end of the interrogation.
So do I understand you to be saying that if extrapolating to this case, it would make no difference if the appellant were a lance corporal or a general? It'd make a difference, an officer subordinate to the XO, so we'll make the XO a major general and the appellant a brigadier general, okay? Makes no difference?
Your Honor, it would make a difference from whether the order was enforceable, or I suppose whether the order came from a superior.
But not in terms of your Griffin factors?
Well, only to that extent, only to the extent that if the order came from a subordinate, it certainly wouldn't carry near as much weight. Also, as I mentioned, the last factor regarding...
Why should that make any sense? And there may be a reason, but I wonder, if the question of custody is related in its purpose in Miranda to the question of the voluntariness of a statement and the question of whether a person is feeling under compulsion or not, why shouldn't all the factors in that individual's makeup be important in determining whether that individual reasonably felt that they were in custody and thereby felt the compulsion to make a statement undermining voluntariness?
Your Honor, I see I'm about out of time. May I answer your question?
Please do.
As I understand, you're asking why shouldn't all those factors be taken into Miranda analysis?
For purposes of determining whether someone is in custody, that is in response to the questions asked earlier, does it make any difference what a person's grade is, rank, other things about their life experience? Shouldn't we look at what a person, a reasonable person, having those experiences would or would not feel that they were in custody for purposes of feeling the compulsion that was at issue in Miranda when the Supreme Court said we're going to make custody the touchstone because it has a compulsory process to it in terms of undermining voluntariness?
Your Honor, from my understanding of Miranda, the court seemed to have separated the Miranda as a carved it out as a portion of voluntariness in general. And those factors certainly would come in the voluntariness analysis, but as far as Miranda's concerned, it's been restrained to an objective analysis in the evolution of the court's decisions.
In terms of the requirement for the warnings?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor.
Thank you. Please, you may take the time you need to briefly conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Judge. Your Honors, for these reasons, the amicus curiae in favor of the appellee asks that this court affirm Chatfield's affirm Chatfield's conviction because he was not in custody at the time of his admission. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal? Would the clerk remind us of the time that was reserved for a rebuttal here? Thank you. Please proceed.
There are some additional findings of fact that are erroneous that appellant would like to draw to the court's attention here. A finding of fact, number one, actually, is that at the time of the statement, the accused was a 35-year-old male. He may have been 38 years old at the time of trial, but it's more relevant what his age was at the time of the offense. Appellant would just like to point that out.
Hang on. Is this critical to your argument, or are you just pointing out?
No, I'm just pointing out.
So the CCA says he's 36. The military judge says he's 38, and you're saying he's 35?
He's 35, and so it's not critical.
Okay. Counsel, I can't speak for my colleagues here, but I would be grateful if you would focus on those findings of fact that you believe to be an error that are critical to your analysis, and we will, at least from my point, accept that there may be other irrelevant matters in the findings of fact that the judge got wrong.
Certainly, Your Honor. Another critical finding of fact, number 14, the finding that word was passed back, appellant alleges that that's in error. The XO is the only one that testified that word was passed back, and there was no independent evidence of that.
Well, why is that an error? There was nobody that testified that word wasn't passed back.
There is no one that testified contrary, but it is very ambiguous that word was passed back. He could not even identify who passed back that information.
So it's a little bit nebulous, but there's no conflicting testimony.
It's a little bit nebulous. It's just that appellant would like that to draw that to the court's attention, that they find that ambiguous. Findings of fact number 21, 23, and 24. Additionally, appellant takes issue with the joint appendix at 100 addresses the finding of fact number 21. There was never a plan for Lieutenant J.G. Chatfield to go to dinner. The plan was that when the interview was completed, he could either call us or if we finished dinner, we would come back, pick him up, and get him something to eat before we went back to the ship.
Is there any dispute among the parties on that fact?
There is no dispute on the parties on that fact. Just going briefly to 23 and 24, the XO did not believe that the accused was in custody because he was only there for an interview. Now, this conflicts with some testimony by the XO that he thought that they would read him his Miranda rights when he got to the police station. So there would be no need to read anybody Miranda rights if he wasn't in custody. Number 24, the detective had no expectation that he would arrest the accused or that the arrest of the accused was likely under the circumstances as he understood him at the time. That is actually incorrect. He knew that these were very serious offenses that he was interviewing.
But didn't he say he was going to give him a ride to the restaurant after the interview was over? And how does that reflect that he thought he was going to be arrested?
Admittedly, Your Honor, that does reflect that. It reflects the status of the evidence, I suppose, as opposed to the seriousness of the charges. Briefly, appellant would like to address that there is no possibility that this was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The government has admitted that the rest of the evidence in this case was circumstantial. A confession is the highest form of proof at law. In addition to this confession about rubbing her down below, you have the incredibly damaging evidence of Detective Amanetti in soliciting this confession from the accused, in his comments on digital penetration, and that the accused actually admitted digital penetration to him, but it was not in the confession. So given that, there's no way that this error can be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. This court must remand this case and authorize a rehearing. If that concludes the court's questions, then that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. We thank counsel for both amici for your presentation today as well. The case is now submitted, and the court will take it under advisement. After the clerk adjourns the court, which will happen shortly, the judges will remain in place for an informal question and answer session. Thank you.